Attempting to get through the papers this morning. My panel in studio, Aidan Regan, who's an associate professor at the School of Politics and International Relations in UCD. Good morning to you, Aidan.
Morning.
Nice of you to pull the tea just to your mouth while I was about to say hello to you. Sheila Riley is the head of digital at Iconic Newspapers and a former editor of the Longford Leader. Good morning to you, Sheila.
Good morning, Aidan.
And Larry Donnelly is a Boston attorney and law lecturer at NUI Galway. Good morning to you, Larry.
Good morning.
Thank you all very much for coming in to be with me this morning. Let's have a look at the front pages of the newspapers. We'll start with the Business Post, which predicts or starts, as you would expect, of course, with their own latest opinion poll. Exclusive, it says, Fianna Fáil in front as Sinn Féin support surges. Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin is out in front in the race to form the next government, according to the latest Business Post Red Sea poll, amid a dramatic surge in support for Sinn Féin at Fine Gael's expense. With 2 weeks until polling day, Fianna Fáil is up 2 points to 26%, but support for Fine Gael has dropped by 7 points to 23, the party's lowest ever rating during Leo Varadkar's time as party leader. This is the first time Fianna Fáil has polled ahead of Fine Gael in the Red Sea series since April of 2017, which of course is a couple of months before Leo Varadkar took over. Sinn Féin has been the biggest beneficiary, with its support up by 8 points to 19%. The poll was taken between Thursday the 16th of January and Wednesday the 22nd, meaning that any impact from the first head-to-head debate on Virgin Media between Varadkar and Martin was not captured. It goes on to tell us, by the way, and Micheál Martin will be visiting constituencies this week where the party is hoping to gain seats, and he also told the Business Post that he was going to launch a plan to outline what Fianna Fáil would do in government in its first 100 days if elected. I'm eager to get at it if we get elected, Micheál Martin said. We won't be hanging around. There's key issues in health and housing that have to be addressed. Also on the front page, another health story from Susan Mitchell. Building projects at risk over Children's Hospital overrun. That's a warning from the HSE. Documents seen by the Business Post show the HSE board was warned that the capital plan for 2020 to 24 was very vulnerable due to fluctuations in expenditure on the National Children's Hospital. When an overspend in 1 year reduces the funding available to other projects, an underspend will not benefit those other projects. Front page of the Sunday Times. Fianna Fáil Fine Gael grand coalition can't be ruled out, says Varadkar. I know Micheál Martin has other opinions, but Leo Varadkar is letting us know what he thinks. The Taoiseach and Taoiseach have increased the pressure on Fianna Fáil to agree to a potential grand coalition with Fine Gael after the general election, depending on the Dáil arithmetic. Leo Varadkar said that while a coalition was not something he wanted, it may be the only way to avoid a second general election this year if smaller parties and independents did not have enough seats to make up a stable coalition. Essentially, what Fianna Fáil is saying is that they won't work with Fine Gael or Sinn Féin. So if the numbers don't add up with Labour, the Greens and independents, they'll go off in a huff and they'll cause a second election, said Varadkar in an interview with the Sunday Times. That's not very grown up or responsible, and that would happen ironically in the middle of the talks on the Brexit trade deal. Fine Gael's deputy leader Simon Coveney said he personally could work in government with Micheál Martin, despite what he said at the manifesto launch on Friday, so you know, clearly whichever way the wind is blowing. Fine Gael members would be a little uncomfortable with the grand coalition, he said, but they wouldn't rule it out. Also on the front page of the Sunday Times this morning, Green Manifesto permits cyclists to break red lights. School children can look forward to an end of homework. Possession of up to a week's supply of drugs would no longer be a criminal offence. Pedestrians would never have to wait longer than 30 seconds for the green man. That is all elements of the Green Party's proposals. That's on the front page of the Sunday Times. And also, former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern claimed more than €26,000 in secretarial allowances from the state between July and October of last year, records released under Freedom of Information show. The money was paid to a recruitment agency which Ahern hired to carry out secretarial assistance over those 5 months. He was the only ex-Taoiseach to claim the allowance, which was abolished in 2012 but discreetly reinstated in 2017 by Leo Varadkar. Front page of the Sunday Independent doesn't deal with the election. There is a sidebar story about a row between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil over the cost of the next public sector pay deal, but the main story alongside that picture, which is on the front page of a lot of papers today, that's of Andrew McGinley alongside his children Connor, Carla and Dara. The piece by Maeve Sheehan and Alan O'Keefe says that the three children who were found dead in their home in Newcastle in West Dublin on Friday evening were discovered by their father after he returned home from work. Gardaí believe that Connor, who was 9, Dara, who was 7, and 3-year-old Carla McGinley died sometime between Friday afternoon and around 7 p.m. that evening. Their father, Andrew, arrived home to find his distraught wife being treated by ambulance personnel at their home. He went into the home to discover one of the children downstairs and the other two in an upstairs room. Similar story on the front page of the Irish Mail on Sunday, which says that the father of the three young children was the person to discover the unimaginable tragedy. The mother had been previously spotted by a taxi driver walking outside a graveyard in the locality. He got her into the cab and took her home as she was able to provide the address. But along the journey, her overdose made her unresponsive. And the front page of the Sunday World, similar story again. It was the father of the three young children found dead in their home who discovered their lifeless bodies after arriving at the County Dublin house. The headline there is Three Little Angels. Just on the political theme, by the way, inside the Irish Mail on Sunday, it is, of course, not the front page story, but they do have an opinion poll of their own conducted by Ireland Thinks, and it again has very similar findings. The last comparable poll was in November, but since then Fianna Fáil are up 2 points to 27, Fine Gael are down 6 to 22, and Sinn Féin are up 5 to 20. So pretty similar findings across all of those opinion polls. Aidan, what do you make of the two opinion polls that we've seen this morning?
Yeah, I mean, they're fairly consistent in terms of the other opinion polls that we've had over the past couple of weeks, but I thought there was one or two things that stood out to me, which is the generational difference and the home ownership distance. So, for example, in the Ireland Thinks polls, it specifies quite clearly that those who rent from local authorities and those who are in the private rental sector are significantly more likely to vote for Sinn Féin. Those who own their houses outright are more likely to vote for Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. So there's a kind of housing dynamic at play there which overlaps and intersects with age.
Is there a kind of an I'm all right, Jack, sense to it, that if you're able to own your own home, if you already got onto the property ladder at this point, then the acute housing concerns are far less of an issue for you?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, and this is, we know this from looking at public opinion polling over the past 8 years, housing clearly dominates. Then in the business poll, you see it again. I mean, the Sinn Féin, I think, is a standout figure there. They're up quite significantly. But even the Red Sea poll in the Business Post adjusts downwards Sinn Féin support because it calculates, and probably based on a fair assumption, that their voters are less likely to turn out to vote. So, I mean, Sinn Féin are probably slightly higher and probably more in line with what the Ireland Think poll says. So, yeah, the real standout story for me in terms of those polls is less the kind of stability of the 25%, let's say, of Fianna Fáil, but significant rise for Sinn Féin.
Larry, your thoughts on this morning's opinion polls. Do you agree with Aidan's findings?
I agree with a lot of what he said. I think Fianna Fáil, obviously, they won't admit it, but they have to be privately very pleased. And I think especially in the context that they're out ahead again, and Fianna Fáil traditionally does better on the day than the polls suggest, so they have to be happy. I think Fine Gael obviously won't be pleased. I think one thing perhaps that stands out in the Ireland Thinks poll, is which was conducted this week, is that Kevin Cunningham indicates that after the debate, the decline in Fine Gael's fortunes was less pronounced.
Which, yeah, because this is the only poll so far which had some of its field work out in the field after the Wednesday night debate between Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin.
And I think that suggests two things. First, that Leo Varadkar won the debate, which I think most people believe. And then secondly, I think his attempt during the debate to, I suppose, humanize, for lack of a better word, himself by saying that his words don't actually always reflect what he thinks. I think that that was effective. I know some people thought it was cynical and reacted in kind. I actually think it worked. I think it was something he needed to do because I think he's vulnerable on that point. So I think that will be some encouragement, I suppose, to Fine Gael. And again, Sinn Féin, their numbers are stronger than I think a lot of people suggested, notwithstanding Aidan's good point about what will happen on the day. And I think that's down to something I identified over Christmas and in the run-up. There is a lot of anger out there. There is anger about housing. There's anger about homelessness. There's anger about the health system. It seems to me pretty clear that Sinn Féin has been the political beneficiary of that anger.
What's interesting about that note of Leo Varadkar's empathetic note at that debate on Wednesday night, Michael Brennan has a very interesting piece in his analysis on page 13 of the Business Post today. Now, it was advice from Leo Varadkar's partner, he says, that helped him during one of the standout moments. That Varadkar, when he was addressing this idea that people say he doesn't have empathy, he had his answer ready because of something that his partner Matt Barrett had said to him. And the quote is that people always say you don't care, but every time you come home, you're talking about all the problems in the country, Barrett told him one evening. Varadkar decided to use that line in his response to Pat Kenny's question, and lo and behold, here we are talking about it now. Sheila, your thoughts on the two opinion polls and whether they might be replicated, or whether you still think that there's a bit of flux in there?
Oh, there's definitely a bit of flux. I mean, we've still got a bit to go. There's no doubt about that. But like, you'd have to say they've been fairly consistent. And as Larry and Aidan have both alluded to there, particularly today. I think what's interesting, there's a couple of aspects to it for me. In the Business Post poll, you see that Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil are most trusted to sort out housing and health. And that's really important because we know they are the biggest issues. In fact, in the Mail poll, it says 35% of people, which is no change, 35% of respondents said housing was the most, but that health was the most important issue for 31% of respondents, and that's up 16 since their last poll in November. I thought that was really interesting, but then that's the time of year, so inevitably you're going to have that because the trolley crisis is to the fore. It's the time of year for the health issue
to come
to play.
Who's from a border area yourself, are you surprised that the same Ireland Thinks poll in the Mail on Sunday finds that only now 5% of people say that Brexit is their most pressing concern, and that's down 10 points from November? Is there a sense that now, because the British election has sort of rinsed all that through, that people sort of think that Brexit is a fait accompli?
Yeah, and Matt Cooper kind of has a very good piece in the Business Post today which kind of deals with that too. Yeah, I am surprised, I'd say, but I'm not as surprised as Fine Gael, who are hanging their hat on this, let's face it. And really, people should be more concerned about Brexit, and particularly in the border areas. Like in places like Cavan and Monaghan, you could be talking about well over one quarter of jobs are in sectors that are going to be directly affected by Brexit, like agriculture, like tourism, manufacturing, those sectors. And even say in Longford, where I'm based, you're still talking about 21% of jobs are in those sectors. So people should be more wary and concerned about Brexit. Mm. But it absolutely is not lighting any fires in this election. People are done with it. They feel, look, it's happening. We're coming to the end of the month. We're going into the transitional period. Then they'll be gone out of the EU. We're going into the transitional period. It's all going to wash out anyway. There's that sense. The sense is it's the domestic issues that are at play here.
But politically speaking, I mean, isn't it the fact that Brexit isn't an issue largely a result of the fact that the main parties, at least, are on the same page when it comes to Brexit? There's really not much difference. Mm. Fianna Fáil arguably can make the case that it did the right thing in the context of Brexit by standing by the government.
Well, and the other major opposition parties ostensibly would have sought to achieve largely the same goals in terms of a certain special status for Northern Ireland as well. Is maybe Fine Gael talking about Brexit supposed to be a proxy for them pointing out the strength of their front bench? Because what you might say is that the likes of Fianna Fáil or potentially Sinn Féin would not have had the personnel to achieve the same success that they have.
I suspect that's the case, and I think objectively speaking, I don't think anybody can criticise the job that both Simon Coveney, Helen McEntee, Neil Richmond and others have done on it.
Aidan, yeah. What I find interesting about the Red Sea poll is that there's a very interesting graphic on page 14 as well. It's slightly confusing because the Fianna Fáil bar is coloured in blue and the Fine Gael one is in green, so it's a little bit counterintuitive. But what it does say is that it breaks down the amount of the electorate who would maybe consider voting for each of the parties, and Fianna Fáil is at 48 there, Sinn Féin 42 and Fine Gael at 41, which I find very striking, because the idea that Sinn Féin potentially is fishing in a bigger pool than Fine Gael would be is quite striking. But it also says is that of the 19% that Sinn Féin has in this opinion poll, 17% of those are absolutely definitive voters. Yes, I'm absolutely voting Sinn Féin, which means that if that were to materialise on the day, Sinn Féin might be disappointed that it's 17%, but it's still the biggest that it would ever have, and it would still mean some pretty significant gains, which really would chime towards their narrative of trying to break the big two establishment that they've been telling us about.
Yeah, I mean, and what we know as well is that those who are going to vote Sinn Féin will vote Sinn Féin. They have a core anchor, I would say, quite simply put, they are becoming the working class party of Ireland, and particularly in Dublin. They represent pretty much, I would say, the bottom quintile of the income distribution in terms of the electorate and further up the field. They've been trying for the past couple of years to reach out further afield, with Mary Lou MacDonald in particular, trying to develop a certain persona which would reach out more broadly to kind of middle Ireland. But they have a core anchor, and the question is whether or not that will turn out to, they will turn out to vote for them.
That is the question, though, is whether they'll turn out, because particularly not only is it the lower quintile in terms of income, but that we saw in the Irish Times poll during the week that they're the most popular party with under 35s. But as we can see, in even with the way that the pensions issue has come to the fore, that people always tend to focus on the concerns of older voters because they are the ones who do actually show up.
And it's this under 35 vote that's going to be really important to them. I think that's where they're going to begin to make big gains. And I think that's, if you're under 35 and you're not happy with how things are and you're quite frankly annoyed with the housing situation, the healthcare system, all the different things that Larry pointed out that people are particularly angry about, who are you going to vote for? Who's your main opposition? You're probably looking to Sinn Féin. And I think that is that is something that will concern Fianna Fáil, because Fianna Fáil are not popular amongst young people, where Sinn Féin are. So the question is, so Sinn Féin are becoming the working class party of Ireland and also the party of choice for younger people, which is not that different, I think, it's pointed out by in the Business Post as well. The kind of voter, the kind of millennial socialist voter in the USA voting for Bernie Sanders, or the millennial socialist voter voting for Corbyn in the UK, clearly Sinn Féin are tapping into that momentum as well. And unlike a lot of other countries, they're being able to build a relatively cohesive coalition between different groups within society that many parties on the left elsewhere in Europe and the USA cannot do. Mm.
We'll talk about that pensions issue, by the way, after the next ad break. But on your point about how Sinn Féin have become the predominant vehicle for younger voters as well, what's really striking about this graphic that I mentioned on page 14 of the Business Post is that of the 4% of people who answered this poll who say that they would vote Labour, that is the current first preference, that effectively that there are not many more people who say that they are going to vote Labour beyond the 4% that this poll has found. So that party really finds itself in a very difficult situation. Larry, on Aidan's observation, though, about how Sinn Féin is now becoming the party of younger people, we heard from Fine Gael that the whole reason why this election was called for Saturday was to try and enable more younger people to vote. Is that a tactic that could well come back to bite them? Or was it a case of hubris where Fine Gael genuinely thought that it had a stronger proposition for younger people?
It's a good question that I honestly don't know the answer to. I think it's probably a factor of a lot of things. I think one of the reasons, and Leo Varadkar adverted to this when he spoke, was the idea of people who work and struggling people with childcare and everything else, that's the reason they did it. At least ostensibly, that's why he said they would do it. Whether they thought they would poll better with young people, I think is an open question. But to the points that Aidan made, I think the two most important things in electoral politics are luck and timing. In a way, Sinn Féin has been quite lucky to have been excluded from the leaders' debate. It's because it plays into a narrative that a lot of people, young people especially, who are angry, will go along with. That is that the establishment is keeping them out. I think it's working very much to their advantage. The other question, and this is an open question, I've been thinking about it a lot, is the extent to which among young people, if Sinn Féin does become the receptacle for that anger and for young people who are frustrated about housing, worried about the future, etc., I wonder to what extent the Greens could perhaps be collateral damage out of that. In a sense that could emerge that, yes, climate change is an issue, yes, it's there, but in some way it's almost a luxury. We need to worry first and foremost about getting a roof over our heads before we worry about the planet.
Yeah, and I think there's a class dynamic to that as well. I mean, I think younger urban graduates, right, in Dublin are probably going to vote for Greens, and Greens are a real competition for Fine Gael in that sense. But outside of that cohort, I think it's Sinn Féin that are clearly mobilising that vote. So I think Greens, the Green Party, you know, are probably relatively comfortable at that 8, 10%, and I think in all probability they're going to be competing for a seat in every Dublin constituency.
Yeah, I'm trying to pull up the demographic breakdown again of the Irish Times poll, but I think, again, it was very striking that I think the Green vote was 15% among people in the A and B social bits, which is like the upper quintile. So the idea that with people who are less concerned about the money in their pockets can afford to vote Green. But then again, Sheila, this Ireland Thinks poll says that climate is only the most pressing concern for only 5% of voters.
Isn't that really interesting? And that's only up one since the last poll. So that'll tell you, I think, you know, when it comes down to it is meat and potatoes, you know, that's going to get people out. That's just the reality of it. I think part of the reason Fine Gael called that election on Saturday was they thought they would be riding high with that youth vote, that 18 to 34 cohort, on the social issues. After the marriage referendum and after the repeal vote, I think they thought they would be able to kind of still make some hay out of the social capital they had gained on those issues, and clearly that's not actually coming to pass.
There is a kind of a Maslow's hierarchy of needs thing, though, there, isn't it? That they think that they're the most liberal party and people want to vote on liberal causes, but that people still are concerned about the roof over their heads first.
If you look at that, look at the Business Post poll, and they break down there, like, when they look at the 18 to 34% cohort, like 35% of them said they felt that Sinn Féin were best placed to handle the housing crisis. Now, Ona Wren is a hugely impressive performer and is very kind of presents their plan in a very clear and, you know, easy to digest way. And I think that message, their message, you know, is resounding, is hitting home. You know, the idea that they're going to build 100,000 houses on public land in the duration of the next government, that message has kind of seeped into people's consciousness. I've heard that line, and I've heard some of their key housing points being repeated to me a number of times in the last couple of days. That tells me people are taking in what they're saying.
And also the point on the rent freeze. I mean, if you're in the private rental sector in Dublin City or other urban cities across Ireland, you know, and you're seeing your rent going up all the time, you're constantly insecure, you're paranoid about the landlord coming in saying they're going to sell the house, and somebody's coming along giving you a clear saying, we are going to put a rent freeze. Whatever, we could debate the economics of that all day.
Or the constitutionality
cost,
too.
All that stuff. But at the end of the day, that gives certainty and security to a lot of people. Say, actually, you know what? I'm going to be more secure for the next 5 years in this highly volatile private rental market.
Just on the topic of housing, by the way, Aidan, I know that you've been writing elsewhere, but do you have a problem with the use of the phrase social housing? What is your concern about that?
Well, I just think, it's not picked up that much in the newspapers and this weekend, but it seems to me that one of the biggest obstacles to solving the affordability question of housing in Ireland and in Dublin is the extent to which different households are not happy to have social housing next door to them, right? Everybody seems to be in favour of social housing, but just not next door to them. Mm. Everybody's in favour of the state building more housing, but just somewhere else, you know? Mm. And it seems to me, you know, that the kind of the narrative, the story of the corporation, the local authority building council housing has a kind of connotation with social problems. And those, I think that's putting off and putting a lot of public opinion away from having a serious conversation about the need for the state to get back into the business of building housing.
But do you think if it was referred to as being like public housing?
Yeah, so I think there has to be a change in the story. There has to be a change in the narrative and the language that's used around all of this. And I think Sinn Féin, to a certain extent, are doing that. They're saying we're going to build public housing on public land. Mm. But public housing has a much broader connotation. It gets closer to things like you see in Vienna, elsewhere. It doesn't necessarily mean the local authority, the corporation are going to be ones putting the bricks in the ground, etc. Yeah. Mm. It opens it up to have a serious... And I think, personally, I could be completely wrong, that it's going to be a lot easier to bring public opinion along with you on that, if you start talking about it in terms of public housing. Nobody says social education or social transport, right? So yeah. Public education, public transport. And if we're going to increase the overall housing stock to get serious about solving the housing crisis, in this city in particular, the state is going to have to be building housing. It's that simple.
Yeah, it all seems fairly logical. Larry, your thoughts on that? Yeah. That sounds pretty rational, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And a colleague just made a point to me on two things that were addressed by Aidan and Sheila. Persuasive point. I'll rob them from... The first is that the extent to which young people, I think, are engaged and young people see Owen O'Brien putting forward a very serious policy in terms of housing. One that's not... You can characterize it ideological if you want, but it's a very serious policy as to how to address housing needs. And that partly explains why young people are flocking to Sinn Féin, at least according to the opinion polls. The other point with respect to the social issues and Fine Gael definitely thinking they could make hay, I agree entirely with Sheila, is that a lot of young people, I think, will see through some of the stuff, some of the social media posts and some of the kind of riding along the coast of victory and capturing the trend and all that, and see that it was probably a lot of other people who did the groundwork on some of those social issues a long time before. And then to some extent, Fine Gael's kind of riding along that coattails.
Yeah, that's very true. And even at the time, they were very vocal that they were not the people who were leading this, that they were responding to grassroots movements. So the idea that they're trying to present themselves as a liberating force, maybe not so much. I found the demographics of that Irish Times poll, by the way. During the week, it found that among 25 to 34 year olds, who you'd imagine were the ones most concerned by housing concerns and the like and the cost of rent, Sinn Féin had 32% of their support. Fianna Fáil was 18. The Fine Gael then were on 14. Over 65s, people who might be least concerned, Fianna Fáil 40, Fine Gael 26, Sinn Féin 12. And on a similar note, when you talk about the AB demographic, which is the most middle class and upper middle class voters, Fine Gael 34, the Greens had 18% of support there, Fianna Fáil 15, Sinn Féin only 7. Go to the opposite end of D&E, working and lower class people, Fianna Fáil 28, Sinn Féin 26, Fine Gael 16, the Greens, by the way, 3%. So
yeah,
I guess
you see,
there's
we forget that Fianna Fáil are taking out of that pool as well. You know, we do kind of sometimes forget that we have a kind of a different association with Fianna Fáil, but they would have traditionally pulled from that cohort too. That's where you're going to see a good battle with them and Sinn Féin. You know, I don't think we're going to see that Sinn Féin poll transferred to on election day, to be quite honest. Mm. I think it'll become shakier as time goes on.
We'll talk go ahead before I go.
I think we forget that Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin will be a head to head there in that. And also I want to mention the independents there. You know, there's no doubt about it, the rise of Sinn Féin in the polls is eating away at the independent vote too. That's going to impact them, because if you've got that vote, that kind of left leaning voter going away from the establishment, you're an independent inclined voter, but maybe you're not going to go for your independent. Maybe you're sick of them, or they mightn't have the option of them, or whatever. But you'll see there, like in the mail posts, they're down 5%. They're both at 11, and in the business posts, they're at 14% down too. But that's been pretty consistent.
And you could make the case that ultimately Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil are competing for a similar class vote, except Fianna Fáil are competing for the older rural working class vote, and Sinn Féin are mopping up the younger working class vote.
One thing we haven't mentioned yet. I don't think Labour can be very pleased with the results of these polls. It suggests that the seat targets that Brendan Holland had set out are almost fantasyful.
Yeah, well, if there's only 4 or 5% of people voting Labour, and like I said, that business post poll suggesting that there's not many more people who maybe even would consider voting Labour, it's certainly some difficult times for them.
There's going to be a lot of critical self-reflection within the Labour Party after this election.
They're coming to the point where their critical self-reflection needs to actually be really serious, because we've had a couple of episodes of it in the last number of elections, and it seems to have gotten them absolutely nowhere.
Yeah, maybe
they are sinking into irrelevance fast. Maybe unless they do something.
the local elections where they had a little bit of a revival might have been the bounce, but maybe it was perhaps dead cat bounce. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about the concerns of older voters, including the political controversy over pensions, as well as fairness and whether we are going back to the auction politics of the past. A listener has got in touch to 53106. That will cost you 30 cents, by the way. They want to know if there's an undecided figure in both polls. They don't see it in either of the papers. Very good question. We have asked the pollsters Ireland Thinks, who've carried out that Mail on Sunday poll, to give us a figure if they have one for the undecideds. The Sunday Business Post, sorry, that's the first time of the show. I made it to 11:30 before I called them the Sunday Business Post. That's all right. The Business Post has published the full PDF of their figures online. It's behind a paywall for those of you who are Business Post subscribers. It says that the number of undecided voters is a mere 8%, which is in serious contrast to what some of the other polls have found, where the undecideds is somewhere close to 20%. Mm. Maybe they categorise them in different ways, but the Business Post and Red Sea say that only 8% at this moment in time are unsure of exactly how they're going to be voting. Still joined in studio by Aidan Regan, Sheila Riley and Larry Donnelly to go through some of what is said in the papers. There's a lot said in the papers today about the fallout from the pensions controversy and how a change that was actually made nearly 9 years ago is still proving to be such a political hot potato in this particular election. Dan O'Brien is writing in the Sunday Independent about how we need to keep working after 65 or else it's the young who will pay. Brendan O'Connor is wondering if gradual retirement is the answer to the crisis. Sarah McInerney is writing in the Sunday Times about how the Stop 67 campaign should spare a thought for the young, arguing that they are the ones who will actually carry more of a societal burden because of the costs of the banking collapse. Brian Keegan is in the Business Post. Politicians beware, the greying brigade is coming of age. Surely if they are greying, then they have already come of age, perhaps. Business Post, Dermot O'Leary as well. We cannot afford to defer the increase in the pension age. And Aidan Regan, who, as it happens, is sitting here beside me, says our income divide will shape this election in two ways. Aidan, how so?
Well, I mean, in two ways, in the sense that firstly, it's worth noting that 85% of people in Ireland have a gross income of less than 50,000 euros, mm-hmm. right? A lot of people would be surprised to know that if you earn 60,000 euros and above, really about 62, 63, you're in the top decile, the top 10% of income earners.
Okay.
You earn 85,000 euros, you're in the top 5% of income earners. You earn 100,000 euros, you're in the top 1%, right? And then the top 0.3% above 200,000, so on. And I think that this reality is lost on a lot of the commentary on politics in Ireland, because there is a lot of people out there who are really struggling. And that's before we account for all of those high cost of living issues related to housing and childcare. There was a survey released last week, surprisingly didn't get picked up that much in the media, by a German company that analyzes basically the cost of living for families in different cities. Dublin ranks 120th out of 150 cities. It's expensive place to be, and people's incomes are not great. However, there is a cohort of people that are doing particularly well, and they tend to work in the foreign-owned multinational sectors where income growth is, earnings are going up by double-digit figures. You know, if you're 25 years old working in Google and you're single, things are probably pretty good for you, right? Mm. But you're not represented.
Especially because your employer will now provide your housing as well.
Exactly.
So you see the acute pressure.
You're doing well. It's boom time for you. And in a sense, also 70% of people who work in Google, the biggest private sector employer in Dublin City, actually are non-Irish, so probably don't have a vote. And they probably would be voting Liberal centre-right, which would be Fine Gael in Dublin City. So the narrative and the story of Ireland's successful growth model is not seeping down into voting behaviour, and that doesn't surprise me if you look concretely at the actual data. The second thing is the regional concentration of this stuff, right? Ireland has experienced really high levels of what we call occupational upgrading. There's a lot of good jobs being created. 42% of jobs in Ireland today are classified as high skill.
Okay.
Managers, associate managers, all that sort of
occupational
stuff.
Occupational upgrading is a new one.
They will be typically voting Fine Gael, right? But they're highly concentrated in the city areas. I mean, if you look, and they're typically in the foreign direct investment sectors as well. 85% of all foreign direct investment sectors in the higher skilled occupations in Ireland are concentrated in Dublin, Cork, Galway, Limerick, right? So there's a regional concentration to what's going on here, and an income concentration. And surprise, surprise, there's not that many votes. You're talking about 15% of the population, and that 15% of the population are probably going to vote Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, but they're not representative of the broader society.
Mm. Give us those figures again, because just you mentioned if you earn a certain amount that you are within the top. So if you earn over 50,000 euro, which means that you get the full benefit of the income tax changes that Fine Gael is proposing, what percentage of society are you if you're over 50,000?
If you're over 50,000, you're beginning to enter. You're beginning to enter into the top quintile, the top 20% of earners.
Okay. So only the top 20% would stand to gain the full amount of what Fine Gael is proposing by way of increasing the tax cutoff point.
The tax change that Fine Gael are proposing, which is to increase the higher rate from those at 35 to 50, mm-hmm. would probably benefit, my instinct would tell me, my guess, about 18% of people.
18% of people.
Some might say 22.
How does what you're all saying there, by the way, how does it compare and contrast with what the ESRI were saying during the week, which Matt Cooper has been talking about and Dan O'Brien too?
I mean, it's fairly consistent. I mean, so basically what the ESRI report did, and they're not the only ones to do it, like people out in UCD have been doing this research, Brian Nolan over in the UK have been doing this research. Ireland has one of the highest levels of market income inequalities in the OECD. Why is that? Well, for two reasons. On the one hand, there is a very large low-wage sector in Ireland. 22% of people are classified as low-paid and full-time employment in Ireland. In addition to that, you've got a lot of basically zero income households in terms of earnings, but they have earnings or gross income from the state. So you have a lot of people who are reliant upon social transfers from the state, and you've got a relatively large low wage sector. But on top of that, you do have a cohort of people who have very, very good earnings, and that pulls out the distribution effectively. However, the ESRI have pointed out, and many others have pointed out, that the income tax system in Ireland is highly progressive. Basically what that means is the state taxes higher income earners in Ireland and redistributes it through the welfare system in order to bring up the incomes of those at the bottom of the distribution and equalise it, meaning that Ireland looks about average in the OECD after taxes and transfers.
So average. Now, not necessarily a great performer, but average. We're not necessarily any more equal or unequal than any other developed economy.
Before the state intervenes in tax and transfer, Ireland looks like the USA, basically. It looks like the UK. But we haven't had the kind of Trump-like backlash, right? And I think a large part of the reason for that is that the welfare state does exactly what it's supposed to do. It taxes higher income earners and it redistributes it downwards. Now, a lot of people will be unhappy with that. Many of your listeners are saying, well, we don't want that, right? Yeah. But that's the reality. That's what it does. And I think it does mitigate against social conflict.
But doesn't it also highlight the regional?
Yes, very much so.
You know, like that just obviously, because I'm from a rural area, that just absolutely jumped out at me when I read your piece this morning. You know, just the kind of the regional distribution that you have there. The fact that these jobs have been created, but they are consistently being created in urban areas. Now, for obvious reasons, I understand why that's happening. But what you're seeing time and time again is they're particularly being created in Dublin, and then they don't have the housing or the infrastructure to back up these jobs. Yeah. I mean, like, it's just absolutely crazy. And then what you're creating is this cohort of people who are travelling from places like where I live, or in Cavan or whatever, where there's 5,000 people travelling a day up to Dublin. You know, so 4 hours a day of their lives been spent, every day of their working lives been spent on the road. Like, it's absolutely crazy. Yeah. Like, I am glad to see this issue being raised a number of times during this campaign. I just don't see kind of what's going to happen, though, to actually change the lives of somebody who's getting in their car tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock, leaving Cavan or Longford or Monaghan or these places to hit one of the motorways. And, you know, like, as somebody said who was out canvassing to me last week, he said the problem with canvassing those people, say in places like Virginia and Belgium stuff, where people are travelling all the time, is he says their issues are actually more Dublin issues than they are Virginia or Ballyduff issues, if you know what I mean. You know, they're more concerned about the M50, about infrastructure and things like that. And he says, and it's hard for us to kind of connect in with them for that reason.
Just on that rough topic, by the way, I'm pretty sure, being from Meath, I remember the figure being given. I don't know whether it's necessarily the only county over 50%, but I know that Meath is the county that has the most, in terms of percentage of its population, that aren't there during working hours, that it has essentially the most mobile
and
population.
Leash because and they Kildare, all I think, as well.
Are based effectively in Dublin.
Yeah. And this is what puts Ireland 120, sorry, Dublin 120 out of 150 cities in terms of quality of life.
Orla Hegarty gets in touch on Twitter to say that housing policy is climate policy. That's when we were talking earlier on about the different priorities of people. What we build, where we build and how we build is critical. In fact, the billions for housing investment is the best lever that we have for climate adaptation if it's used strategically. And someone called Noble Guardian on Twitter says, how can Sinn Féin claim to represent young people when they're simultaneously shafting them with the cost of pensions? Larry, your thoughts on that? Because this does bring up the whole issue of what Aidan was calling there the intergenerational inequality, because it feeds so much into the pension debate where politicians are tripping over themselves not to upset 65-year-olds.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose events and unanticipated events are things that kind of had take a big prominent role in elections. And I don't think anybody saw this one necessarily coming. And of course, there is the old reality that older people vote, and there is very, very strong lobby in that sense. You know, there's a couple of realities, I think, here. The first is that political reality that I mentioned about the power of the gray vote, so to speak. The second, however, is, you know, young people, and you know, the reality is that there are less workers, there are the pensions. A lot of us, I suppose, who are, you know, in my case, in mid-40s, don't anticipate being able to retire anytime before 70 because of that, and how it could be, you know, while it's politically tempting to do something on this front, it could be irresponsible if we were to reduce the pension age in the sense of who's going to pay for it? How are we going to afford this massive liability? And I think that that's, you know, again, where short-termism, which dominates politics, can be a bad consequence. I think Sarah McInerney writes about this, I think, in pretty provocative tones today. I hope she's not planning to stand for office anytime soon. but she makes a very reasonable point in that sense about young people and all the things that they're going to be saddled with, and things like home ownership being unattainable. So there's serious issues to reconcile.
If it might be irresponsible to raise, or to lower rather, the retirement age perhaps back to the 65 from which it was at the start of the last decade, then why are politicians tripping over themselves so much to present themselves as being prudent on the one hand, but also to do what is potentially a very irresponsible thing on the other?
Three words. My uncle was in politics a long time, and he said to me, old people vote.
Is it as simple as that, Sheila? Is it the case that all the prudence that we might have seen different parties proclaiming to preach over the last couple of years, that it all goes out the window, and that they might just completely reverse tack when it comes to an issue that might kick them out of office?
Which would be absolutely crazy. But yeah, and for the exact reason that Larry is after saying, yes, this is a hot button issue which nobody really had anticipated. Now, it has been bubbling a little bit over the last couple of years. And I think in particular, it's the nature of, you know, that the fact that people were going in, had to claim job seekers, had to pretend, to be looking for a job if they were forced to retire at 65 in that interim period. And that, to me, I thought that was the big gripe with them. Not necessarily the rising retirement age, because, like, realistically, we need to increase the retirement age for the reasons outlined by Sarah McInerney in her piece, Dan O'Brien in his piece. You know, I mean, the reality is the burden is going to go back on young people. That pool is shrinking. The pool over 65 is shrinking. How the hell are we going to pay for all this if we don't increase the pension age? Like, you know, and you cannot allow something. You're in my mind veering into 1977 territory of given, you know, the Fianna Fáil giveaway election. You're veering into that territory when you're in this scenario that people do. The parties need to pull back, be a bit responsible, show a bit of spine, if you like, and say, look, this is what we will be fair with the people. We'll come up with a plan for people so they don't have to go and claim job seekers in between 65 and 68. That's fine. But still, the retirement age should be increased. Mm. I mean, it's just totally illogical that they would allow this to take over. But having said all that, we all know the reality of an election. This is the issue that's dominating. It's certainly the one that's been brought up. I absolutely know it's been brought up in the canvas time and time again. They are definitely getting hit with it on the doors. So they have to do something.
Don't make me go and dig out those demographic figures again, because it took me long enough to find the first time. By the way, on that listener's question of the undecideds in the Mail on Sunday poll, I haven't got the answer back yet from the pollsters, but Owen O'Brien of Sinn Féin has been following the question on Twitter as well. He says that the undecideds in that poll are 22%. So 8% of people are undecided according to Red Sea, and 22% of them are undecided according to Ireland Thinks.
Like, would you not imagine that should be in around 20% at this stage, that undecided?
I think every other poll did have it around 20 odds.
Yeah, I mean, that should be what it is.
Larry, you're putting your finger up there. You want to come
back? I just want to come back, because I've been thinking about it since I read Aidan's piece and going through those numbers, which are just extraordinary and surprising in many levels to me. And, you know, we've all asked the question how, you know, unlike elsewhere, the center is held here and is held really remarkably strong. The research that Aidan and others have done make me question how much longer the center can hold. Aidan points to the role of the welfare state in, I suppose, keeping it there. I just wonder how much longer it can hold.
Aidan, your thoughts on how much longer the center can hold?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by center, right? I mean, for example, there's other research done. I've done with a colleague of mine, Johan Elking in UCD. If you look across Western Europe in particular, and also if you include the United States of America, and you say, who's voting right-wing populist, right? And we've talked about this on the show before. Yeah. You know, it tends to be a certain cohort of the population. If you take the European Social Survey, you map it out, and you look at in Ireland, where does Ireland fit in terms of this story? Well, basically, the story there is that the same people who would typically be voting or who are turning towards the far right in the rest of Western Europe, in Ireland, will turn towards Sinn Féin. Now, the interesting thing on top of that, unlike these other countries, we see in these polls, younger millennial voters who would typically go towards the left, Bernie Sanders voters in the USA, or kind of Corbyn supporters in the UK, are also turning towards Sinn Féin. So Sinn Féin might be in a rather unique position
it's
of building
it's both
a
ends of the horseshoe theory.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think for many left-ish parties across Western Europe, they would look at Sinn Féin with great envy in that sense, right? Yeah. Because this is something that's very qualitatively unique to Ireland. But for me, if you just look at the underlying labour market changes, the demographic changes, the structural changes in the economy, you know, you can see this stuff being played out. And in that sense, I agree. I mean, Fine Gael represent a particular higher income vote, and it is increasingly concentrated in urban liberal areas. And, you know, they're getting pressure and competition from Greens, Social Democrats, and arguably in the past a bit more from Labour. So that's a completely different, that's a kind of different dynamic to what would, I don't think Fine Gael are competing with Sinn Féin for that type of vote, but at the younger vote, they probably are, which changes everything.
But Sinn Féin still have, where the parties looking in wouldn't envy Sinn Féin is they still have the baggage.
Yeah.
They still have the baggage of the past for a lot of older voters, and that the bottom line is when they get in there and they have their little pencil in their hand, the reality is they're just, there's a lot of people out there who still will not be able to cross the line for Sinn Féin because of that baggage.
You know, for sure, Sinn Féin have been quite, so your point is absolutely crucial, which you made a moment ago, right? Which is that this whole thing about the pensions emerged from what? It wasn't so much a debate upon the fiscal capacity of the state to pay this. And you look across Europe, it's a huge debate on pension welfare reform. Sinn Féin just realised that there was a lot of people out there who've been working 30, 40 years of their lives in pretty hard jobs who are suddenly having to claim job seekers allowance before they get the pension. That's what they did. And they articulated it.
Yeah,
no, and they were worse off as well, because there's a gap between obviously between what they were getting on job seekers and what they get in the pension. So they were actually worse off by a couple of thousand every year as a result.
The construction side for 30 years as opposed to university. Big difference when you hit 65.
Absolutely. We'll pick up a lot of that. There's an awful lot of listener reaction to coming in, so we'll read you some of the texts and tweets and discuss that a little bit more. Loads of texts and tweets coming in to 53106 about the discussion that we were having about the state pension. One person says, the young voters are full of themselves. The current 65-year-olds started work between age 14 and 16. Current young people start work at 24 to 26. Older people have earned their retirement by 65. The current young will have not. That is from Lar. Someone says, why do civil servants qualify for both a work and a state pension when they're paying only 8% since 2008? That is from D. I think some people who are still paying the pension levy will be pretty aggrieved about that. No one is talking about the elephant in the room, says another texter. Public sector workers can retire after 40 years working, so at 60 they could have the full pension. If 66 or 67 is good enough for the private sector, it should be good enough for the public sector too. And someone else, Anne in Wicklow, says it's a very ageist discussion on the pension issue. Older people now, they paid way higher taxes during the 70s and 80s with less social welfare. They had no access to third level compared to the younger people in Ireland last 20 years.
They were going
years.
To school in bare feet. Spare me.
No sympathy from Sheila then, no. No sympathy for that point though, but these people who started their working lives much earlier and they paid much higher taxes.
I do to a degree, but I also look at, say, 24-year-olds, 25-year-olds in this country or even in their mid-30s, people who cannot afford houses and will probably realistically never be able to afford them, you know, and paying exorbitant costs for childcare. At every hand's turn, they're getting hammered left, right and centre, and they're not getting, you know, they're not getting benefits or not getting any type of benefits or anything like that. That cohort, and who is going to pay their pensions when the time comes, that cohort are absolutely getting hammered. So that's it. The age is part of the discussion, if you ask me.
Jim in Wexford says, the biggest issue with changing the retirement age is that there's no requirement for employers to extend employment contracts at the same time. So in the private sector, you still have many people being turfed out at 65. Surely that's the obvious thing to rectify. Which I suppose, Aidan, is, does the state actually have the power? Can it like feasibly legislate to say that if you've got a contractual retirement age that you can just push it out?
Larry's probably the best Larry one question, to answer actually. That question, yeah. I would say.
I knew you were going to ask me. I'll give a lawyerly answer. I think there would be difficulties with that.
Okay. Would there be difficulties with the constitutional rent freeze, by the way, do you think? Maybe, I appreciate that might not be your level or your department of the law.
It's not my department. I haven't read that. I know the legal opinion is out there. I haven't read it, but I don't think it's crystal clear one way or the other. And I think it's one of my bugbears is the legal advice. We got legal advice, so we can't do this. You know, the reality is it's just one lawyer's opinion. Yeah. Another lawyer might have a very different opinion.
So one Fine Gael barrister says one thing and one Fianna Fáil barrister says another. But because the Fine Gael barrister is the Attorney General, then it completely turns everything on its head. Gavin, for a lot of people, Sinn Féin's baggage doesn't matter, says one texter. When I have to pay 800 quid for a room in a house with six strangers, I care about housing policy and the type of society that has been created by Fine Gael. Sinn Féin doesn't need to appeal to everyone. They just need to have policies and people who advocate fairness and a decent society. Aidan?
Yeah, I mean, I think that captures quite well what we see in the opinion polls and the conversation we're having here. I think it's fairly consistent. I mean, I would look at the Ireland Thinks poll and it says very clearly those who are in the private rental sector or are renting from the local authorities are significantly more likely to vote for Sinn Féin than those who own their own house or have a mortgage, who are more likely to vote for Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil. So there's a clear housing intergenerational inequality divide opening up.
Someone else says that Sinn Féin have had no scrutiny about its policies, no property tax, etc., one for everyone in the audience. That might be because Sinn Féin hasn't yet published its manifesto, but we will talk to Piers Doherty about that in the second hour. We will, of course, talk to Regina Doherty about this whole pensions issue because she is the minister responsible for that. Joe in Dublin says, if Sinn Féin were anything more than controlled opposition, they'd be running more than 42 candidates, which goes to another point that I will raise with Piers Doherty later on, which is the whole question of Sinn Féin trying to portray Mary Lou McDonald as a credible candidate for Taoiseach and wanting to have her included in TV debates, Sheila, when Sinn Féin are running 42 candidates, which means that even if they have the best possible day, they will still only just about control slightly over a quarter of the Dáil, and whether that's really a feasible basis in which you can build a government.
Well, it is a feasible basis, isn't it? I mean, in reality, she could be Taoiseach.
But she's presenting herself as a candidate for Taoiseach.
Perfectly entitled to present herself as that candidate. And I think as well that she should be included in those debates, particularly when you see the type of figures that they are polling at this stage. I think, you know, we touched on it earlier on, excluding her has kind of fed into a narrative that suits them in lots of ways. And we will never have them under, you know, they won't be under that type of scrutiny, you know, unless she's brought forward for these debates and gets to kind of battle it out on that platform. I mean, we can argue at length about, you know, the effectiveness these debates, do they actually change people's minds and all of that
sort of stuff. The closer we get to polling day, they do.
They do. They definitely make a difference, as you said, the closer we get to polling day.
Larry.
And that's for that reason she should be included in it.
I absolutely agree with everything Sheila said. The other thing, as we look to the next week of the campaign, I expect Sinn Féin to come under tremendous attack this week, both about the past and about its economics, and particular things like flight of capital. I can already hear the attacks coming.
I'm going to put the final question to Aidan, who I want to address this question from George in Skibbereen, who says that I know the parties have published their manifestos, but I'm not really one for reading fiction. I've decided to vote for the party that promises to give me a unicorn. I really want a unicorn. Can you please tell me which one will make this promise? Thank you, George from Skibbereen.
Well, the unicorns, I mean, you could start looking at the corporate tax sector as well if you want to look for unicorns there.
Of course, you went for the official answer. Lads, we're completely out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. Big thank you to all of you for coming in this morning. Always appreciate giving so much of your time on a Sunday morning. Aidan Regan from the School of Politics and International Relations at UCD. Sheila Riley, who's the head of digital at Iconic Newspapers. And Larry Donnelly, law lecturer at NUI Galway.